G'day there, guys, and welcome back to Blowing Cartridges, your fortnightly video game podcast talking about not just games, but the culture surrounding them. I'm one of your hosts, Zach, and joined as always by my lovely co-host, Brendan. Brendan, how are you now that our time zones, both in yours and ours, have shifted thanks to daylight savings?
Well, overall, I'm not a fan of daylight savings. I think it should be abolished everywhere in the world. But this is not a fringe political podcast, so we won't go into that particular discussion right now today. No, I think it's good. The stars are aligning, and we'll be able to keep on making podcasts. And actually, I think this might be one of the longest streaks we have of sort of hitting that fortnightly slash maybe sometimes a bit longer on the fortnight, but. We're doing a lot better schedule-wise, so I think unless sort of I think some things are thrown up at us that I don't know, the dungeons are flipped or we have to restart and redo things again for no apparent reason, we should be okay.
Yes, and the other streak we've kept is having a guest pretty much since November last year, maybe a bit earlier, and we've managed to keep that streak going with a returning guest this time, our friend Mario, unrelated to the Super Mario. Mario, how are you going?
Very well, and excited to be here for another episode of Blowing Cartridges.
Yeah, we didn't quite scare Mario off last time, so it's good that he has returned.
Yes, and we've got you back on for a sort of adjacent. So last time we had you on talking about sort of Western RPGs, and we're doing another genre-related episode this time with Metroidvanias, which is it's a bit of a hot topic at the moment. I feel like it's been a hot topic for the last few years, but there's just so many of them coming out. But like at the moment, you know, we've had a Prince of Persia Metroidvania come out and do well at the start of this year, at least critically, sales-wise, is it maybe a different story. We've got a bunch of upcoming ones that are high profile, like, you know, EA is doing Tales of Kenzaru Zao coming out in a few weeks from when we're recording. And of course, you know, there's a lot of rumor, a lot of, you know, buzz around. Are we getting Silksong? Is it coming? Korea seems to think so. Koreans have rated it. We've got Xbox putting listings. So, you know, feels like a timely time to talk about what's become really a pretty like mammoth genre, I would say, in the gaming space in, you know, 2024 and even the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. Before we start though, in terms of delving into the topic, I'm keen to sort of get, you know, both of your, you know, experiences with the genre. So perhaps starting with Brendan, what was sort of like your introduction to Metroidvanias and, you know, just at a high level, what's sort of your experience with them after, you know, you first got your taste of one?
Well, I think thinking back, and I just mentioned this to you before we started recording, I think I do remember the first one I played, and it is the Metroid side of Metroidvania. So it'd be Metroid Fusion, which, well, it's an interesting genre in terms of, and I'm sure we'll get into it a bit over the course of this, in terms of, well, where did the name come from and what actually constitutes a Metroidvania? But I would argue in many ways that from the Metroid side, probably Metroid Fusion, some would argue, isn't really a Metroidvania because there's moments where you're forced, there's forced story progression. That, yes, there is your backtracking and your item upgrades and the like as per your normal Metroid formula, but it is a bit more, you're gated in some ways. So that's probably a topic we're going to take up later. So I very much started with Metroidvania before the genre title is really used. I don't know when we'd actually highlight the moment when it started becoming an acceptable genre name. I'd say probably the last 15, 10 years, roughly, give or take. But from there, it's probably, for me anyway, it's been a genre that I enjoy, but I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite genres. I'm not the sort of person that will seek out to play all the Metroidvanias that are releasing and play all, because, well, there's so many that release. I know we're in a Discord chat, Zach, where we do, there is someone in that Discord that does seem to play nearly every Metroidvania that does come out. So, well, it's like any genre. There's some people that will seek out all the experiences in that genre. But for me, it's mainly been the main games here or there. So Metroid Fusion, starting with Metroid Dread a couple of years ago. I love The Messenger. That was, I think, 2018, 2019. And then, well, Hollow Knight, of course. And your classics that come along. So, but for example, I've never played Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is sort of the other end of that start of the supposed genre on the Vania side. So there's that that's sort of a very potted history of my experience with the genre. So I'll hand it over to Mario.
Yeah, sure. I mean, unknown to me at the time, I would say my Metroidvania journey started playing Metroid Prime on the GameCube. So I think I only got a third of the way through the game before I decided, nope, this is too scary for me as a child.
I remember playing the demos in, like, I think it was like a David Jones or a Meyer, and I just didn't really understand that for, because it starts you off at the very start, and you have to go through the door, and I'm like, I don't really understand what's going on. I don't quite understand this game.
Yeah, it's a bit of a daunting experience when you're that young, but... and then I kind of dropped off the genre for a long time, pretty much until Hollow Knight. That was the first time I sort of got back into it and really appreciated the genre itself. And since then, I've played a couple of others, like the Ori series. They're really good. Dipped my toes in Guacamole and also Salt and Sanctuary. There's a couple of other ones. But yeah, I'd say that's where my journey really started.
Yeah, I think all three of us are somewhat similar, I guess, with starting with the Metroid side of the coin. I think that's important, and we'll get into that in a second, moving on to also why the genre is called what it is. But yeah, I probably would have dabbled with Metroid Prime as well, but never owned it as a kid. Would have played it like at a friend's house for like a little bit or watched them play. But I think the first one I actually like vividly recall playing through start to finish was Metroid Other M of all the Metroid games, which is probably, again, losing me a lot of credibility amongst fans of Metroid and the genre. But, you know, I enjoyed it, and I think it was, you know, it definitely ticked all the key boxes, I think, of a Metroidvania from a genre perspective. And I don't think that, you know, was the key issues with the game that people had. But, you know, since then, similar, I've dabbled quite a lot, you know, particularly in the indie space, whether it's Hollow Knight, Guacamole, as you mentioned, Mario, or gone back and tried, you know, Symphony of the Night, for example, as part of a bit of a, you know, exercise a bunch of my friends and I do on, you know, picking games to go through and play. And did, you know, that was one we picked 1 month just to acclimate ourselves with it, because we realized very few of us actually gone through and done it. So yeah, sort of, you know, grown to appreciate it, but certainly I'm not at the obsessive level like some people are. And again, that's something we'll delve into later in the show, but we've teased it a few times. Let's talk about this weird name of a genre, because if you are not a big gamer, you probably hear the words Metroidvania, and that is a bunch of sounds coming out of my mouth that don't make any sense in the English language outside of the video game space. But yeah, clearly a portmanteau of the word Metroid, and as we've said a few times, Castlevania, so the last few words there or letters there. But very specifically, the origins are probably linked to, well, arguably sort of the way it panned out, I think, is not as straightforward as like, oh, Castlevania and Metroid came out and they were similar, because that's not really how it occurred, right? The original Metroid is arguably the original Metroidvania. Like, it came out, what, 1986? It probably has all the key hallmarks. There might be some other game that's a bit more obscure that does, but that's hard when I'm, you know, doing even just sort of cursory Google searches to find anyone linking a pre-Metroid game that ticked the genre's buckets, what we would consider the staples of it. And then Castlevania, which came out probably a few years later, didn't actually, you know, wasn't really what we would consider a modern Metroidvania. It was a bit more linear in its structure. And it really wasn't till most likely Symphony of the Night. There's some argument that Castlevania 2 was a bit more like it, but Symphony of the Night on the PlayStation, you know, almost over a decade or so later from Metroid, that sort of, I think, really solidified and took that sort of approach that Metroid does. And, you know, probably now's a good time to talk about what that style of game is. So I don't know, Brennan, do you want to take a crack at sort of describing some of what we would consider the key tropes that make up a Metroidvania as we know it today?
Sure, Zach, and it is one of those, I think it is one of those genre titles that is a bit inane and really only makes sense to people who, well, are already gamers. It's similar to, well, what's become Souls-like, which is a completely different topic, which we won't start here. But it's, again, it's, I think you can distill it into, like you were hinting at, some key gameplay tropes and mechanics. And it's, and I think I sort of hinted at it when I was talking about my experience with the genre, in terms of, I think, firstly, you have that backtracking element. So I think that's a key part, and why, for example, the first Castlevania wouldn't be considered a Metroidvania, because it was more of a progression-based action platformer. So it's stage-based, you're always going forward and you're never going back to the same locations that you'd been to previously, which I think that is key to the Metroidvania genre, is that you're returning to places. And the other side of that coin is you're returning to places with, firstly, more knowledge about how the game works. So you've progressed and you understand the mechanics a bit better. So there might be some obstacles that you can get past that you weren't able to get past when you first started the game. So, and I guess those are the games that sometimes you can do things outside of a progression order, that if you understand how the game works, you can do things out of the order and the game still handles that well. And that's not, I guess, unique to the Metroidvania genre. Like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom allows you to do that. And those aren't Metroidvanias. So maybe we'll get back to that point. But I think the other side of that equation is that you're collecting generally some sort of upgrade, or you're gaining abilities through your gameplay. So you might see, for example, a red door. And to get through that red door, you have to have a certain type of weapon or missile or whatever you want to call it. And when you first see that red door, you can't open it, but you've gained that item upgrade, that weapon upgrade, and you know that, oh, this weapon allows me to open red doors. I can go back to the very beginning of the game, or near the beginning of the game, and open that red door and see what's in there. So I think that also shows one of the, I think, from a gamer perspective, from a player perspective, what I guess is compelling about Metroidvanias, and is that curiosity element, that you see something and you bank it in your brain, you remember it, and you think, oh, well, I can't do anything with that now. I can't go there, but because I know how these games work, or even if I don't know how the games work, I'm just curious. I want to know what's in that door, and I might try 5-10 minutes to get past an obstacle or a door and figure out, well, I can't get through it yet. And I guess part of the joy is to go back and find out what's in there. But then again, and I think this is something that I'll throw to Mario in a second, but I think this is something that's also difficult with defining it as a genre, in terms of that's also not unique to the genre type. Like, again, there's your 3D adventure games, like your Zelda likes. I think, again, we're going to keep on hitting genres that don't really have names, like games like The Legend of Zelda don't really fit in a particular genre type, but also has a lot of the tropes that are in Metroidvanias, like getting different upgrades, going back to previous areas. So maybe there is a more, I guess, nuanced underpinning explanation of Metroidvania that makes it more of a distinct genre than I've just rambled off.
Yeah. Sorry, you go, Mario.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I guess from my understanding, that's pretty much what it is, though, Brendan. But that's a very interesting point, because, like you said, there are games such as Legend of Zelda, which are clearly, they're not in the Metroidvania classification, but they do have those elements of, okay, now I've got a hook and I can get to somewhere that I can, or like, I can upgrade my skills to get to somewhere that I, or do something that I couldn't beforehand. So I guess, it's interesting to why have we classified these particular sort of 2D side-scrolling kinds of games as Metroidvanias when other 3D games aren't considered that?
Yeah, it's probably also like an element of where the name and everything comes from, and then sort of at what point do you, I guess, make the distinction between a Metroidvania and another genre. Because, like, again, going back to when the term first popped up, again, it's hard to pinpoint an exact who coined the term Metroidvania, but
Well, Reddit. I know. Despite people claiming it, I know Jeremy Parrish said it wasn't him. So
yes, so we've eliminated one out of however many billion people did not. It wasn't either any of us here either. For that, for the record, we were all just babies. Well, not actual babies, but close enough. But it certainly seems to have come around sort of the GBA era, and sort of a way of describing in particular the Castlevania games of that era, because it was sort of a transition, right? Symphony of the Night with Igarashi at the head then kind of took the Castlevania franchise into its Metroidvania era, as well as we started to probably get a few other games take on that genre, but certainly not as many as we do in the modern era, I would say.
And I think, not to interrupt you again, Zach, well, I just did interrupt you, but an interesting factor to the descriptor genre title is that it is generally primarily used for 2D games. So that's what I found interesting, that both you and Mario, when we were talking about sort of gateways into Metroid, well, Mario mentioned Metroid Prime, and we sort of acknowledged that as the Metroidvania, whereas I think your, well, for lack of a better term, your traditional description of the genre would very much focus it on the 2D realm.
Yeah, and I think that's what I'm sort of getting at, is it's kind of like you have to have enough elements to be a Metroidvania, and I think in some ways it doesn't have to be perfect and have all the elements, because Metroid Prime, it's not 2D, but it's got Metroid in it, so it's kind of got to be a Metroidvania, right? Like, it's a bit weird. Metroid Prime Pinball, maybe that's doesn't make the cut.
And Federation Force is definitely not a Metroidvania, is it?
Yes, true. Clear spin-offs. But, I mean, it's interesting as well, just, like, pausing for a second on why the term popped up then, because, like, we do have plenty of, there's quite a couple of other genres based on specific game franchise. Like, you mentioned Souls-likes before, Brendan, and Roguelike is probably the other big one, from a game that arguably, I'd say, more people don't actually know what rogue is than know the term roguelike, I would say. Like, yes. I don't know if Mario, could you picture what rogue looks like in your head if I asked you to draw a picture of that game?
Absolutely not. No. I don't even know if I know the game. But I know roguelite, and obviously that genre is being saturated at the moment.
Very similar to Metroidvanias. But it's interesting that it didn't just become like Metroid-like or Metroid whatever. It only was on that precipice of Symphony of the Night taking on the Metroid qualities. I think that's also why the genre sort of had focused so heavily on labeling 2D games, right? Because, again, this is all speculation, and that's, again, part of the point of this podcast is just to ramble a bit and speculate and stuff no one can prove. But before then, the genre had to have another name because it existed, to an extent. And it would have just been, either platformer or action platformer. I've heard some people use the term explorative platformer, but it was heavily linked to being a platformer, not too dissimilar to Mario or Sonic or something like that, just bundled together in classing them. I guess one thing I'd be keen to get your view on, I mean, to any of those, would you have preferred if they stuck rather than going Metroidvania, or are you pretty happy with that becoming the terminology we now just use almost universally to describe these platformers with big worlds we explore and get new powers that we use to open the next area or certain locations?
I think it's quite nice that we're sort of paying homage to some of the pioneers in the gaming industry, such as Metroid and Castlevania. So I think the terminology is good, but then it sort of also questions, well, why aren't we doing that for other games? Like, why don't we call every open world game a Zelda-ish game? It's very curious why we've just hone down on these couple of genres to be quite specific, and then there's obviously a lot of other ones that we've just called like, okay, this is open world, this is an action RPG, this is an RPG, this is all these different other ones.
I think in some ways it's because it's similar to why Souls like took off, in terms of these are games that are replicable, that you can replicate the the gameplay tropes and mechanics to a degree that people recognize where your influence is from. So that's what they stuck on to the descriptor for how we're going to describe these games. Well, it's a 2D platformer. It's like Metroid. It's like Castlevania Symphony of the Night. We'll call it a Metroidvania. I think the first, when you do your Google searches, Zach, I think for memory, the first one that pops up is sort of Cave Story from the mid-2000s. And that's that was an indie game made on, I think, Flash or Java, I think, or one of those platforms from memory. It was a Flash game, wasn't it, I think?
I think so. It was definitely free. I remember that, like indie game out of Japan. But yeah, I forget what core engine it ran on, yeah.
Yeah, so I think, that, to my point, I think replication is a key, I guess, reason why these names stick and others don't, to answer, I guess, Mario's musing in terms of, if you think about it, there's not really that many games like 3D Legend of Zelda. Like, you have 3D Legend of Zelda, you had games like, in your mid to late 2000s, Darksiders, Okami, and games like that, that, like, when they came out, people, and some games journalists and people in online forums and the like, started using the term Zelda-like, or like, these are Zelda games because they were very similar. But, and this is just me speculating, I think due to, well, how much actually the resources it takes to make those games, and no one else really started replicating that. You couldn't have indie developers and the like making 3D games to that level and that scope. So it didn't really take off like it has for both Dark Souls and Metroidvania or Metroidvania games. So that would be some of my, I guess, 2 cents to add to that, this discussion.
I also do wonder if it's just because if I try and cast my mind back and even like trying to look up lists, sort of not until recently did you actually have an abundance of what we would now call Metroidvanias, right? Like,
yeah, it's a Kickstarter phenomenon, really.
Yeah, it's really come into its own in the last decade, I'd say. And because I was trying to like find some early ones. You obviously point out Cave Story. The only other one, and I'm not even 100% confident it is the original Shantae, just because I know the more recent ones are Metroidvanias, but I'm not actually sure if that original Game Boy one would classify.
The other one would be Shadow Complex.
Oh, yeah, on the Xbox 360 by Epic, I think it was, wasn't it, at the time?
Yeah, Epic, and they had Orson Scott Card do the story for memory.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But I do remember Shadow Complex coming out and getting a lot of praise for being a Metroidvania. But going back to whatever the original question was before I went on a massive tangent, but I do want to talk about like the non-2D ones other than Metroid Prime, because there are a few games that can be considered arguably Metroidvanias in a 3D space. One series a lot of people point to is the Batman Arkham series. It's quite Metroidvania like, but even Souls likes, right? Like, they're kind of Metroidvania. You know, you could argue that, Bloodborne or Dark Souls, I'm not as familiar with Demon Souls, but they do have some of the core structure elements of a Metroidvania. So I'd be keen to get both of your takes on that. Maybe Mario, because I know you've played at least a few of the Souls games.
Quite briefly played them. I think, yeah, it's an interesting discussion. I would say it may be a little bit different in the sense that in Souls-like game, you're expected to die quite a lot. And the deaths seem, I'm going to say they seem quite a lot more consequential compared to, say, a Hollow Knight or an Ori or those kinds of ones, where you can sort of just restart in just the last platform that you fell off or something like that. So I think there's a bit more onus on, no, I really don't want to die in a Souls-like game because a lot more bad things can happen to me. Yeah, so I think that, but yeah, I get that it probably could be fair to say they have some very similar aspects to Metroidvanias.
Yeah, I think there's mutability between the terms, because if you flip it the other way, we've mentioned it a few times, but you take your Hollow Knight, for example, a lot of people would classify that in some ways as a Souls-like, because there is some there is some comparison points there, particularly in terms of the difficulty. And I think that's one of the issues with the Souls-like genre description, is that a lot of what makes a Souls-like is the difficulty. And there are some very hard Metroidvanias. Like, I'd agree with Mario that a lot of Metroidvanias, death isn't that big of a factor. But I'd say there's some very, at the same time, there are some ones that are very difficult games.
Yeah, that's true.
And even like Hollow Knight, and I think Mario, you mentioned Salt and Sanctuary, which is, I think they even market it as a Souls-like. But yeah, the other thing for them is that you've lost your stuff and you can go get it again before you go back, which definitely features quite heavily these days in a lot of games. And I'm sure
that's a roguelike sort of trope in many ways.
Yeah.
Like going back to your body.
It's funny how these three subgenres have got quite a lot of crossover, which is probably an interesting point to sort of think about in terms of what sort of attracts so many people to these types of games, because there are absolute fanatics who just can't get enough of this style of explorative structure. What do you think is the big draw card to this style of game, to compared to, say, again, playing a really solid 2D platformer like a Mario or a Sonic game or something? You know, pick your poison, Celeste, or if we're going something more modern. Yeah, what is it about these ones that you think really hooks so many people in and gets a lot of SEO traction these days on the internet when you're marketing your game?
Could be. Well, I think they're pretty easy to play and pick up. Mm-hmm. But there's also a bit of complexity to it as well. So I think gamers, they don't want to just be given something that they can just steamroll through. They want a bit of a challenge when they're gaming, and I think Metroidvania genre, it provides that challenge. It provides a bit of flexibility as well. You don't have to go straight through, a linear game. You don't have to go in a straight line to get to the objective. You've got a few different paths that you can take to get to places, and it challenges you in ways. You know, you have to backtrack sometimes if you want to 100% the game, or if you want to get that secret hidden item, you need to go down this particular path. And I think that reward really pulls people into the genre.
I agree. I think that depth, the inherent depth that people attribute to Metroidvania is a large part of it, because if you look at your Celestes or your Shovel Knights and 2D platformers, I think there's expectation of 2D platformers that, well, it's all a bit like Mario. That's, yes, some are very difficult, but there's not that much more. There's not that much depth outside of getting from point A to B through a level. And some people absolutely love that formula. You have plenty of, fans and enthusiasts of 2D platformers. That's why 2D Mario games continue to sell so much that they do. But I think, to Mario's point, Metroidvania for many people there, and I'd actually, if we get on to talking about, I guess, the limitations and problems of Metroidvanias, I think one of the issues I have with them is that I think it seems like, oh, there's so much to a Metroidvania. There's a lot of depth. There's a lot of exploration possibilities, and it's a lot more of an interesting experience than a 2D platformer, for example. But in many ways, it's there are nearly as many limits to a Metroidvania as there is to a 2D platformer. It's just in different places, and I think that's why a lot of Metroidvanias are similar to other Metroidvanias, that you could and I think why some people devour so many at a quick rate, that if you play one, you've sort of, in many ways, you've played a lot of them. And yes, that's not to say some Metroidvanias do things better than others, because there's always going to be games that are more enjoyable than other games. But I think there is a limiting factor there as to, simultaneously, what makes a Metroidvania unique is also what, in some ways, limits what a Metroidvania is. And I think that's why, as we said, it's sort of been a solid nearly 15 years of these games being pumped out on a sort of weekly, monthly basis, and we haven't got away from that genre definition. It's still the genre title.
Yeah, I've got to imagine a lot of it's got to do with back in the early days, in the same way that I think Zelda struck a big chord with a lot of people when comparing it to NES games they'd played previously, like Mario. Just like the idea of, oh, this is a big kind of world, and I can like get this thing over in this part and then come back, was probably very unique versus, like, again, Mario, very self-contained levels, you know. Yeah, maybe you can like carry your power-ups over between them, but that's kind of about it. There wasn't like, oh, if I got this in world 7 of Mario, I can then bring it back to world 2 and do this kind of thing.
There's not that continuity. There's no it's not a continual breathing world, which is what a Metroidvania in open world games feel like, that you're building progression, where you don't do that in a 2D platform.
Yeah, in some ways, probably it was the start of this sort of somewhat interesting divide between your linear and your open world games, which is always a good back and forth discussion to have over what's better or not. But yeah, keen to see, like, you know, when you're playing Metroidvania, what's kind of like, what makes or breaks them? Because again, there's so many in now, like, you could literally stumble across one probably walking down the street at this point. What sort of, from your experience, this one will stick with me because it has this, versus if it has this, I'm probably gonna put it down. I'm just not interested. Yeah, maybe Mario, do you want to share your thoughts?
I would say the world building is very important, the atmosphere that the game brings, and just the couple that I've played. Yeah, I mean, Hollow Knight being one of them, but also Ori. The soundtrack is just phenomenal for both of those games, for all of those games. It just really makes you feel like you're inside that world. That Hollow Knight has like that sort of dark tinge to it. You're in like this bug world and it's a bit gross, but you're just trying to survive. It really captures the feeling of the game and the atmosphere. So I think that's really important when there's such a saturation of these games, their ability to grab you and bring you into that world, that's what defines it for me.
Yeah, I think that that atmosphere building is important, and I think it's interesting that the ones you quoted and a lot of Metroidvanias do take on that dark, foreboding atmosphere trope. There's probably something there as well in terms of, if we think of the big main Metroidvanias that people think about, like that sort of, there are similar tropes in terms of what atmosphere they target and on that side of the equation. But I think the other part of a Metroidvania for me is or how it controls, how it feels to play, how tactile the movement is, because these are generally games with a degree of platforming, so they have to feel good when you're doing, well, the platforming in them. So I think of something recently that not so recently now, but Metroid Dread from 2020 or 2021? 2020, Metroid Dread.
2021, I think. Yeah.
2021? Oh, okay. Yeah. But yeah, take Metroid Dread, for example. Yes, there are some Metroidvania diehards that don't like Metroid Dread, but for me, that captures a lot of what makes a Metroidvania enjoyable for me, and it just felt well. It felt good to play it. It just we did an entire episode on it back in 2021, Zach, and I think a lot of my comments about that game remain the same. That it's, for me, it hits a lot of the notes that a Metroidvania should, and as Mario said, the atmosphere is good. There's moments of real foreboding and like heightened stakes. The progression feels good when you're building up. You build up your own skills playing the game alongside getting new upgrades, and I think that is essential to a compelling Metroidvania. And then just moving the character around the game world just feels good and it makes sense. And again, it's tied to that. You're building skill throughout the game. There's a real progression. And for me, that's a key part of what makes a Metroidvania.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I love good fluid movement. I think that's like what Ori, for example, does really well. Even like Hollow Knight, you know, you can get really good with your like chaining of your like jumping and hopping around on the enemies and that kind of stuff. I'm probably also a bit of an outlier in terms of like, particularly when I look at the original sort of retro Castlevania and Metroid games. Is for me, I do need good checkpointing. I am not interested in doing a ton of like going back again over stuff that I've already done to get to that difficult boss fight and try again. That kills a lot of it for me. If I just put a checkpoint in front of a big boss fight, don't make me like go through three or four rooms of like, you know, trash enemies or a platforming puzzle to get back to it before I can just go bang and try again. Whoop. That's, you know, certainly more common these days because I think it's just easier to build in, you know, abundance of save points or just, you know, auto save every room, however you want to do it. But like, yes, I remember when I tried Symphony of the Night, it was just such a slog sometimes when the save room is like just three or four rooms away from where the actual challenge you're kind of stuck on is. Mm. And it's also tough because it's like it's away, but like with enough challenge to each thing where even though you've kind of got it down, you still have to concentrate. It's not just like smash through it and then go fight the boss. It was always like, oh, like I need to concentrate and get my timing right in these jumps, or like, you know, if I'm not careful, these mobs could actually destroy me. To me, that's a big make or break, and probably is just like a symptom of being a more modern gamer, not used to the frustration and challenge of retro games as perhaps I was once a long time ago.
Oh, you're not a pro gamer anymore, Zach. You should be very disappointed in yourself.
But I mean, it's why I've beaten, you know, Other M and Metroid Dread, but I haven't beaten like Super Metroid because I just, you know, it's just slightly too tough.
Well, I have finished the original Metroid, but I haven't finished Super Metroid because I was going through a playthrough of it on the Wii U when it was one of those free games they released for it on the Virtual Console, and I think I was able to get to a spot in the game that I shouldn't have been able to get with the upgrades I had, and I sort of didn't really lock myself there, but I was sort of locked there to a degree that I just couldn't be bothered trying to get back to where I was supposed to be, and I just dropped it there. So I do get that level of frustration there that sometimes it's like, well, yes, I understand the exploration side of the Metroidvania is important, but maybe the game shouldn't have let me get here when I'm clearly not supposed to be here right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like a accidental hallmark of the sequence break, right? Like, I don't think it was ever intended to be a thing back in those early games. It just kind of became a thing. And then probably has become a bit more intentional, at least at the indie level. Yet I'm not sure if Nintendo ever bakes in much intentional sequence breaking to modern Metroid.
Do we count Dread as Nintendo? Because that definitely has intentional sequence breaking.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. I guess, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how an accident like that has, though, become a key, I wouldn't say it's a key feature, but a common feature is what I would say.
And going back to Nintendo, one of my early examples, well, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom are the definition of sequence breaking in some ways. That Breath of the Wild, you can turn up in the world and then immediately go and kill Ganon.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's very difficult to do that, but I'd say that's sequence breaking in some ways. Because that's not how they designed the game to be. Well, they designed the game to the degree that you can do that, but that's not the intention of the game designers. They aren't intending you to finish the game in an hour or less than an hour.
Yes, I guess, though, I see that as different to, like, building in, like, ways to get around things that are kind of through initially unintentional mechanics, like the bomb jump from Metroid, like the way how exploitable that was in the early ones was not intended. Right now they build bomb jump puzzles, you know, with that in mind, and like, I mean, if you're good at it in Smash Brothers, you can bloody bomb jump Samus back onto the ledge if you're patient enough. It's pretty hard to do.
Well, not to beat this over your head, Zach, which it feels like I am, but then you look at, well, Breath of the Wild Tears of the Kingdom, that people were doing stuff with Breath of the Wild that the developers didn't intend them to do, and then they baked that into Tears of the Kingdom with your, the Zonai abilities, and they just went full tilt in that direction, which was very much, seemed to many observers to be based on some of the Wild videos you got of people doing things in Breath of the Wild with, like, your Sheikah Slate stuff and like things that weren't intended.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. I would say, though, that's different to like they've literally made it you could walk into the final boss fight because they've just designed the game to not prevent you.
I agree, and I think it also brings us back to like again, entirely not the conversation of this podcast, but the difficulty of, well, the difficulty of placing 3D Zeldas into a genre category and then going back to our very start of the discussion of, well, yes, we classify Metroid Prime as a Metroidvania, and there's probably some things in Metroid Prime that differ quite considerably to a 2D Metroid if we really wanted to pick it apart and think about it. Having played and finally completed Metroid Prime for the first time last year on the Switch remaster that I would classify it as a Metroidvania, I think it does hit all those, well, what people generally consider making a Metroidvania, Metroidvania, as we've discussed. But I think it's the mutability of genre descriptions at some time, categories at sometimes does make it an interesting discussion, because I think ultimately, if we're classifying a genre as a particular type, it's because and why the term Metroidvania caught on and like makes sense to people is because it's exactly that. It makes sense. When you say Metroidvania, we all know what we're talking about. And I think that goes broader to the player base of these games, that they admit, if you say the title, they immediately, you know what it means. And I think that's why it's caught on. Whereas if you use something more, I guess, generalized, like, I don't know, action adventure or action platformer, those become a bit more non-specific. So then you start to broaden out the genre, because genre categories do at some point need to be, well, somewhat descriptive or somewhat limiting in terms of, well, a first-person shooter. It has to be first-person. Like, if it's not a first-person camera perspective, it's immediately not a first-person shooter. You know that from what's included and what's not included.
It's kind of like, this is a very random like analogy, but it makes me think of like wine in like France, where it's like, if you follow all the guidelines, you can say it's from like the suburb. But if you don't follow the guidelines, you can say it's from like the region. But if you make a few more changes, you have to say it's from like, I don't know, the country, equivalent of a state, and then the country eventually. Yeah, and it just goes out and out the more you get away from the like super hard and fast rules.
So the wine from this particular town has to be like grown in this soil and like, yeah, and use these grapes. And yeah, I get what you mean, Zach.
Yeah. Very like random, prefer a like very small percentage of wine aficionados, connoisseurs, probably the right term in that listen to this as well.
What's the difference between a champagne and a sparkling white wine?
What's the difference between, you know, a Hollow Knight and, I don't know, I can't think of a good example.
Shovel Knight.
Shovel Knight. Knights. There you go, that works. Both emblematic knights. Coming back to the tone piece, which you both touched on, because I agree there's always like a bit of a, maybe a bit of a loneliness, maybe a bit of like a sort of, I don't know, but like a serious and sometimes darker, but not always darker tone. Like even Ori Wright's got some dark tones, despite how cute that little fairy guy is. But then there are some examples like, I think Mario, we both brought up Guacamelee, which is very like bright, colorful, cheery. Yeah. Thinking Yoku's Island Express, like Pinball Metroidvania, which is again very cheery. Do we think like there's an element of those breaking too far away because they've got the wrong tone? Or do you think it's... the tone, while is a frequent feature of them, isn't an essential ingredient?
Oh, I think I don't think the tone is an essential ingredient. I think that it's easier to identify it as a Metroidvania if it does have, I mean, Metroid Prime or Metroid rather, and Castlevania, they have those sort of darker tones. So anything that sort of resembles them closer, you can pretty confidently say, okay, this is a Metroidvania. It's got like the same, it's giving you the same feelings. When it's got a bit of a lighter tone, maybe you're thinking it's just like it's a sort of side scroller, it's a 2D platformer, it's like a Mario game, you know, it's all happy and bright. But I think that you'd still identify those lighter games as Metroidvania based on the kind of gameplay elements that we talked about earlier. You've got your gates, or you know, your virtual gates that you need to get upgrades for to get to the next level, things like that.
I have to agree with Mario. I think, well, Yes, I think atmosphere is important, and because you have, well, Castlevania, which is very gothic inspired, and you had Metroid, which was, well, alien inspired, those were intrinsically, well, dark, foreboding, atmospheric ideas. And I think a lot of subsequent Metroidvanias have taken that up, that it's sort of, there needs to be some sort of stakes in the game, that there has to be a tension there, and they fall back on those darker atmospheric tones. But I also agree that if we're distilling it into gameplay mechanics, and of course games like your Yoko Islands Express and your Gatto Roboto and games like that that have not as dark a I think Gatto Roboto, you're still going through dungeons, so you can argue that's probably dark, but you still have a consistent atmosphere, you still have a consistent, I guess, world that's going on that you want to explore. And I think maybe that's better term than, I guess, purely looking at a dark atmosphere to describe a Metroidvania. It's that, I guess, it's the developers of the particular game have created a world that you want to explore. That exploration, yeah, that exploration aspect is important to what makes a Metroidvania a Metroidvania. Because going back to one of my first points, there has to be something in the game that makes you want to go back. That You're not just frustrated that you've got to a point and you've got the new shiny upgrade and you don't know where to go and you just think, oh, I'm going to give up now because it's all too hard and I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. There has to be a reason for you to get that upgrade, learn a new ability and realize that, oh, I need to now, I know exactly what I need to do. I need to go back all the way like to this earlier zone and progress like a Shantae. Shantae is not a deep, foreboding, dark, foreboding game. That's a more bright or tropical island inspired game, and that's the later Shantae games are definitely Metroidvanias, and that's what those games feel like, adventures. It's, you're exploring a world, and I think that's key to what makes a Metroidvania a Metroidvania, that exploration element.
Yeah, it's really nice when you're actually playing a Metroidvania and maybe you're stuck, you don't, like you said, Brendan, you don't really know where to go. And then you kind of have that aha moment where you're like, okay, I remember seeing this thing back there. I've got this item now that lets me get there. Let's go back and see what that unlocks. So, yeah, I think there's really, it's so important to have those elements in there that I think that really defines it, that kind of those moments add to the enjoyability.
On the flip side, curious question. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I'm going to call it the David Jaffe experience, where like,
where you're going.
Yeah, like the solution is like not super obvious, and you spend a lot of time like banging your head against a wall, and then it turns out you just have to like shoot one specific wall, and then it allows you to get through or whatever like that. And
there's nothing
particularly like different about the section of the wall you need to shoot. It's just that part breaks when all the other wall does not. Have you ever had like something like that come up? And is that a good or a bad thing when it has?
I think if, like you're describing, if there's really nothing distinguishing that part of the wall, or if there's no clues pointing to destroying that part of the wall, I think that can be attributed, and I hope this doesn't offend anyone, to poor level design. I think there really needs to be something guiding the players in one way or another to sort of ease the field a little bit, so that we know exactly where to go, because you don't want to build a game that has all these kind of dead ends or perceived dead ends for players. There needs to be some sort of guidance as to, okay, let's move here now or there. If there's a wall that needs to be broken there, and it's like, I don't know, a little gimmicky thing, I think that's fine. But if you need to break the wall to get like an essential upgrade, I think that can be sort of frustrating and game breaking for some people.
You're just remembering the David Jaffe example, I think, well, Metro Prime actually, like in the tutorial, like the early sections, clearly has tutorials where it tells you like some blocks you need to shoot missiles at, or you have to break them. And Metroid Dread like does have some, like there are some walls that you shoot and just open. But I feel like from memory, there are some there's generally some slight hints, and there's some slight, and yes, in some cases there aren't hints, but some people would argue that one of the bonuses, one of the features of the Metroidvania genre is that idea that you need to fully explore your surroundings, that you want to find those secrets. And it's about, from a development and balancing that idea of, well, there's secrets out there and you need to find, and you can find them if you play it in a certain way, and also at the same time not gating your progression, as you just said, Mario, in a way that, oh, your only way you're going to get through this is if you know that you need to do this. It's like the infamous example is, well, both from Zelda 2, which Zach mentioned at the very start, which generally isn't considered a Metroidvania, but then, or Castlevania 2, which also is in that limbo area, where there are elements of those games that there's just inane things that you need to know, that you go to the corner of this particular screen and kneel down when you have this one item, and then a hurricane comes to take you to another part of the world. You just need to know that. Like, there's no hints or anything. You just have to, in Castlevania 2, you just have to know that that happens. And the same with the original Metroid game, in terms of a lot of the upgrades are just behind walls, and there is nothing that distinguishes a particular wall type to another. So you just have to, in many ways, shoot everything and then find where to go. But, and I think there is tension here, though, because, well, the other end of this occurrence, which has entered the gaming discourse in recent years, which I'm sure both of you have come across in some ways, is that discourse over, well, the yellow paint, that a lot of gamers are upset about the yellow paint in games, that there's a lot of these 3D games that will just have effectively the graphic designers will put yellow paint on, well, where this is where you need to go next, this is where you can grab, this is where you can do things, because we've used yellow paint as the indicator in this game world. And a lot of gamers find this jarring, because they think, well, why is there all this yellow paint everywhere? That this isn't an immersive world anymore, that this is, it's clearly a game, which, of course, well, you're playing a game, so of course it's going to be clearly a game. Though, not to be blasé about it, I do understand the reason of, well, the motivation of playing games for that escapism and that those other ideas. So I am in many ways sympathetic to that idea, and I think it does go back to, well, game design, and, well, to what degree do you need to signal to people what something does? And I think that's one of the tensions inherent in Metroidvania, is that, like, there is that, not to the degree of Dark Souls or Souls-like, as we have discussed, but to many Metroidvania, there is that difficulty aspect to the genre type.
Yeah, like there's definitely a contingent of people that say, like, Metroid Dread is too straightforward in terms of knowing where to go versus, you know, getting lost in old ones.
Yeah, and then you have David Jaffe, who couldn't figure out that you have to shoot the block over there.
It's interesting, because, like, I think I'm definitely, again, and this is probably why the genre to me isn't in my, like, top tier. I'm not an addict of it as some people are. If I get too lost for too long, I'm out. Like, I just can't. I'm either Googling it or I'm out. It's one or the other. So I definitely am a more modern gamer. But I definitely think there's, like, there could be some quite elegant solutions. And I, like, this is funny, because I was talking to a friend. I played another Code, the remakes, earlier this year, which are effectively point-and-click adventures but in 3D spaces. And it also made me realize there's a lot of similarities between point-and-click adventures and Metroidvanias in terms of, like, going back and forth between areas, albeit in point-and-click adventures it's usually a bit easier because you're just going, like, I'm in this room and I've got the hammer, and now I go back to that room and I use the hammer to, you know, break the vase, and then the vase is the key to go open the other room. Anyway, but they did a very clever thing with just simply an optional, you can turn this on and we'll point you in the direction if you're getting lost in this mansion, or you just don't. And so you get the best of both worlds. And I know some people are really weird about, like, oh, but if you put the option in there, I'm going to do it, and that sucks because then it makes it easy. It's like, well, I mean, just don't turn it on. That's why it's in the options menu. But anyway, that's, you know, I can't, those people I think are beyond saving in terms of compromise. But I definitely think stuff like that's the way to go, is just, like, even like Hollow Knight, right? Like, its map system, I think, is very clever in terms of, like, it's completely optional. You could have just no map. Well, you can have a map, though it does cost you a little bit in terms of, you know, it's taking up an ability slot, and you're obviously limited in how many of those you can have. So I think there's definitely, like, very clever ways you can sort of have the best of both worlds in terms of making it easier to get around and go back on the critical path, which is what I want, because I do want to be able to like, okay, I'm done exploring. I want to go on the critical path versus people who just want to be getting lost all the time and they don't care if it takes them an excessive amount of time to get back on track. Out of interest, where do you guys land? Are you more, you love getting lost and you don't care, or you do want that sort of ability to go, yes, I'm back on the main story as soon as I'm, you know, sick of wandering around these cabins or whatever it may be?
I think I somewhat agree with you, Zach. I find it a bit frustrating if I just getting lost. I mean, definitely the first time you're exploring a new area, it's really fun. You're like, oh, look at all these different secret passageways to go to. But after a while, I mean, it's a matter of time, right? We all have so limited time and we just want to, I mean, I don't know, from my perspective, I want to enjoy exploring the game. But if I've gone through that this same passageway like 5-6 times, I'm going to start getting a bit frustrated if there's nothing guiding me or no sort of map. But if, there needs to be something sort of there to help me realize, okay, I need to go down or up or a different direction. Yeah.
I'm sort of in the middle in terms of in some situations I do like just that pure exploration, just nosing around the world and finding what's there and seeing like what I can figure out on my own. There's something compelling and satisfying about that. And then I think about my playthrough of Metroid Prime where in some ways like I appreciate it that there are like if you're in an area too long or you're not going towards where you're supposed to go in, I'm not sure if it was in the original Metroid Prime, but it's definitely in the remaster that this basically you'll start being pinged on your map and there will be an arrow saying, oh, you know, you need to go over there. You need to go back to this area. And there were some moments where I found that frustrating because I was like, well, I'm doing all this stuff at the moment. I don't want to I don't want this thing on my map or like the screen indicator just pinging me, telling me to go somewhere else because I know exactly what I'm doing. It makes me feel, and sure, there's sort of there's a timed component to Metroid Prime that like one of the ways completed is to, well, you can do it to time. And I think it does factor into some of the, I might be wrong, but I think there are some slight sort of ending differences depending on how quickly you finish the game. So perhaps it's a good thing they put that in there, but at the same time, it can be frustrating. So I understand why some gamers find that annoying. But overall, I am a relatively linear type of gamer, so I like to know where I need to go. So I do appreciate some of those, well, I guess, interventions that some developers make, and Metroid Dread did it. That, yes, Metroid Dread, you could explore it to your heart's content, but that game could signpost, well, this is where you need to go. Metroid Fusion does exactly the same thing. And, well, Metroid Fusion is, as I mentioned at the outset, is a very gated game that it is very much more go here, go there, go here, go there than some other Metroidvanias, which I know is one of the criticisms that particular game gets from fans. So, again, it's what Zach mentioned, that there is that tension there amongst the player base as to, well, what makes a Metroidvania good, what makes a Metroidvania bad, what degree should there be hand-holding those sort of, I guess, and I would mostly lump those into difficulty questions. How difficult should the game be? And that I think some people do put linearity in terms of if a game is really linear, it's easy. If it's not linear at all, it's hard, which I think is sometimes a deceptive binary, but it's there nonetheless. For me, I don't think getting lost makes the game hard. Like, that's just my perspective. I think, for me, just getting lost is frustrating, like what you said, Zach.
Yeah. But even for, like, what you were saying, Brendan, level design, if you have to go back and forth in between areas multiple times, that's also not even difficulty. That's just the game designers just making you do this arbitrary walking around back and forth between areas. So... I feel like that could also be maybe attributed to not really knowing exactly when you're making a game and then playing it, that there may be there's a disconnect of, okay, not really realizing how much time the developers are making the players move around.
Yeah, I think for me, it's about making a compelling reason that you want to go back and forth, and also...
Yeah.
making that transportation seamless. And I think some games, well, Metroid does that. Well, a lot of Metroidvanias do that with, there'll be, you unlock lifts that go through the world and you find shortcuts. And like, yes, you are, if you think about it, like, objectively, you are just going back for, you're now in the lava area and you're going back to the ice area and you're going back to the lava area. But if the game designers have made interesting and different ways to transfer between those areas, then it does make it, I think, more enjoyable. And you're not really thinking about, oh, well, I'm just going, like, what's the, it's like your old MMO fetch quest idea of, oh,
yes,
I'm going to kill five boars and, well, I need five boar heads and I've killed five boars, but they haven't dropped the five boar heads for some reason because it's RNG. And then I just have to go kill the boars, get the boar heads and go back to the quest giver. And then he'll give me another quest. And now I have to go kill 20 boars for some reason. Yeah. I don't need the heads anymore. I need the tusks. But the other boars I killed didn't drop tusks. But now, because I have this quest, that these boars do drop tusks. And like, I think that's the game design that does, I guess, might boggle the mind of some people, because it doesn't make sense at all and it's not satisfying. It's just, it's busy work. MMO players, some MMO players love the busy work, but others I think just got trapped in the cycle.
The other thing, speaking of just killing mobs in an MMO, but that made me think, alongside the like backtracking, exploration, getting lost element, I think there's like also a really fine art to how you handle enemies and respawning of enemies in a Metroidvania. Like, even though, you know, arguably a very well crafted one, I got lost a little bit in Prime when I was playing HD version whatever last year. There was one room with like these incredibly persistent lasers that I just had. You know, you spend a good amount of time destroying them. You got to dodge, destroy, whatever. And then, like, I just get lost, not know where I'm going, end up back in that room. And, like, every time I had to, like, kill those, I was like, oh, this is just such a slog. But on the flip side, you kind of just don't want to have trash mobs everywhere that don't do any real, you know, anything for you, right? Because it's not engaging if, like, you're at the sort of tail end of the game and every room is just full of, you know, the equivalent of a Goomba walking around, because they don't want to make it too frustrating, but they, you know, you need to sort of ramp up the difficulty. I don't really know if I have more to say on that, but that's just another key thing that you have to get right for me to love it.
It's that question of, well, when you go back to a room, should the enemies be dead?
Yeah.
Like, I've cleared the room, should it stay clear or should it respawn? Most Metroidvanias will respawn. As you mentioned, Zach, some do respawn, but with more difficult enemies. Metro Prime is an example of that. Well, there's a point in the game that you go back to particular areas and, well, now there's invisible space pirates, or now there's, like, there's all these Metroids everywhere. And that, like, to a degree, that becomes a bit frustrating, because you're just, like, I need to get through this room. I need to get from this door to that door. There's all these enemies here now. I don't want to waste my time having to kill them all, so I'm just going to, like, jump around the environment to get past them. So, like, you do start, to Zach's point, you do start to think, well, what's the point of these things being here when it's just sort of a roadblock nuisance I don't want to deal with? But then at the same time, is it compelling game design if I'm going through all these rooms again and there's nothing there anymore because I've already cleared them? That would also be a bit boring, because you're just transferring, you're just walking between empty rooms. So I do understand why respawning enemies is a mechanic. And I think probably the progression take on it is probably the better one, that they do at some point in the game, maybe they change up, the rooms get a bit harder to get through. But I think going through the same Goombas over and over again would be, A, boring and annoying, because, well, they aren't a threat, and B, I actually think that when game designers have changed up previous rooms, it's a game design tell that that's where you need to go. That, like, oh, this room's different. This, like, oh, these new enemies are here, or these enemies I've encountered in this other room are now here. I'm clearly in the right direction. I do need to go back here. Like, I think there's some smart ways through game design that you can use those elements to signpost to the players that, yes, this is where you need to go now, in a not linear sort of hand-holding way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Metroid's got that classic trope, at least in a few of them, where it's like there's a certain story point in a game where, like, I don't know, unleash this, and then yeah, the whole map just going to get slitted with a new enemy type, or the enemies get morphed, which I think definitely quite a lot of others have stolen. Which then, where this is just like how Nintendo peeled my brain is, when made me think of like Luigi's Mansion. I'm like, yeah, like when the boos get unleashed, and then I'm like, is Luigi's Mansion a Metroidvania? And then I'm like,
no,
I've landed on no, because like it's not about getting abilities, which I think is the key. Key thing
we need to draw the line somewhere. But yeah.
And Luigi's Mansion is where the line is.
Stay tuned for our future episode where we discuss what genre is Luigi's Mansion.
How many Luigi's Mansion likes are there? That's a new trend we could start. So we've definitely talked a lot about it, but I want to delve into a bit deeper. Obviously, this genre has really blown up in the indie space. It is like definitely in the top two, if not one, of like premier indies are doing Metroidvanias, right? I would say at least once or twice.
Yeah, that's fair.
Why? that's the question. Why do we think this has become such a big genre in that space? You know, as you, I think you mentioned, the Kickstarter revolution saw a ton of Metroidvanias, Brendan. Versus, again, like, why aren't people just going, I'm going to make a Mario game that I like, or I'm going to make, you know, some other sort of version of a platformer? Why has Metroidvania become the go-to for so many indie studios?
I think it comes down to, and similar to why you also had a growth in platformers like your Shovel Knights and the like, that these are... And it's why I think the genre is very much bound into the 2D realm, and why we also get a lot of roguelikes, is that I think these are genre types that you can make with relatively small teams and relatively limited resources, that you don't need lots of designers mapping 3D models and physics engines and all that stuff, that it can be a bit more constrained development, and it's a bit more straightforward. I think it's... I'm not as blasé to say that everyone can make a Metroidvania, because I don't think that's true. That there's, of course, there's ones that are better than others, but I think one of the leading games. I think a good example is that one of the leading games in the genre is Hollow Knight, which was made by a Team Cherry, a small team of developers in South Australia. And yes, they did it over many years, and they're now doing Silksong again over many years. And I think people are getting frustrated that it's taking so long. But I think that in many ways, that's indicative of why there's so many that, like, you can make, and yes, it might take a while, but you can feasibly make the games over a long period. You can make the games with limited resources over varying periods of time and make satisfying experiences that people want to play. So I think the other side of the equation is, well, clearly they're fun to play. People are buying them, people are playing them. So, of course, people are going to keep on developing them, because there's upside to developing them, and I'm not going to say it's easy to develop. I don't think any game is easy to develop, but the relative ease to develop them makes it attractive for indie developers to develop them, which is similar to roguelites, I would argue. But I think one of the flip sides we probably can chew over is, I think, in many ways, we have so many for those reasons, and maybe there's some other ones you two would like to add. But at some in other regards, there's a limiting factor there that I'd argue in many ways Metroidvanias are very similar to one another. That there are, and we've been discussing it for the last hour, that there's these distinct gameplay tropes, mechanics, and just environmental atmospheric elements that you have to have in a Metroidvania that. Or going back to Metroid and Castlevania, that is limiting in some ways. That yes, there's some Metroidvanias that will bring in roguelike elements, will bring in RPG elements, will bring in Souls-like elements, but in many ways you still have a Metroidvania. That there are, it's somewhat of a constraining genre, is what I'd argue.
Yeah, I think so. I think probably for developers and smaller teams, like you said, Brendan, that because there's all those sort of constraints to what makes a Metroidvania, there's an easy sort of formula for those small teams to follow. But obviously what compels people to play and buy Metroidvanias is the creativity of those small teams. And I think that's the most defining factor. how well they can, how well they can build the game. It's so, I guess, in those Metroidvanias, so important every specific, map or every area you move into is so well designed and crafted. That's why people play those games. If you don't have those kinds of creative elements, if it lacks there, then you're not going to really have a good Metroidvania. And I don't think that's something you could have a massive AAA developer build a Metroidvania game, but if they don't have a strong creative team, then it's going to flop. Obviously on the flip side, you've got a small team, but they have fantastic ideas and they can execute them, then you're going to have a really good, strong game.
I also suspect, because you brought up a while ago the worlds and the like that these games usually are set in. I wonder how much that's probably also got to do with it. Like, you've got innately creative people, they're already probably thinking of this like really cool world they want to create with lore, and they kind of an idea of what it looks like, and then they think, oh well, I'm constrained to a 2D game, I already know I'm not a 3D adventure game isn't on the cards, right? And then the genre just kind of leads itself well to making a world versus, again, like chunked levels which don't feel like a cohesive place that you kind of like function and live in, and probably don't necessarily tick that box of what someone had already envisioned in their head of like, this, bug universe with like, lots of evil bugs and then a few like good bugs, going down this whole, Ori's like forest and that kind of thing. Like, I wonder how much that's got to do with it. Because like even Shovel Knight, right? Like, it's clearly like a world, but it's like a Mario level world. Like, it's like,
yes,
they would happily throw away any sort of string of continuity if it made for an ideal game design component for a new level, right? Whereas there's
and even like a Celeste where the world matters and matters in a different way.
Yeah, correct. What I mean? Yeah, 100%. Like, it's not the world is designed to serve almost the gameplay in some respects. And obviously Celeste, there's also a bit of story symbolism behind it being a mountain, but compared to, again, like Shovel Knight, I don't know, yeah, they can do whatever, and they probably will do whatever going forward. And it's, again, probably why Shovel Knight's got all these random spin-offs now, versus we're probably not going to get like, Hollow Knight the Puzzler or Hollow Knight the just appearing in Ukulele 3 or whatever randomly, that kind of thing. I think hopefully that's been a pretty long chat about the genre and what it is. So I'd be pretty surprised if anyone didn't have a good idea of both what it is and our thoughts on it. But I am keen to hear from you guys, maybe some specific ones we want to recommend or even just chat about. But rather than, I'm happy for you guys to say what your favorites are, but I was thinking more maybe if we take the angle of like one we feel is a bit like underappreciated or less known from each of us, because I think everyone knows the big ones. We've mentioned most of the big ones at least once. So if you have one in your mind that you feel like doesn't get enough love, I'm not saying it has to be incredibly obscure, but you're like, oh, this doesn't get as much praise as perhaps I think it's worth. So I'm happy to throw it to either of you, or I can start if you need time to think.
Now, I have one to come to mind, and you can probably tell me, Zach, if you classify this as a Metroidvania or not, which I think after our long discussion, I think it's quite telling that we're still having this debate over what is Metroidvania or not. But, well, I have two games I could state, and I'll go with one, which, well, it's sort of a series of games, but the Blaster Master games on of Switch, PS4, or modern consoles that came out, I think, between 2017 to about, I want to say 2020, maybe? There's three of them, I believe, the Blaster Master 0, 1, 2, and 3. Would you classify those as platformers or Metroidvania? I think there is definitely a Metroidvania aspect to them.
But yeah. There's
sort of level progression at the same time. So it's a bit less clear cut.
Yeah, they're definitely on the fringe. But for the sake of this, I think we can call them that.
But why I bring them up is I think, yes, they did get some attention when they first came out, particularly the first Blaster Master 0, because it came out near the launch of the Switch when there wasn't that many games on the Switch eShop, which I think, as we all know now, if you go on the Switch eShop, it's just an absolute disaster zone of just games everywhere and no way to actually filter them, and you get slogged down by all the weird sort of SEO sort of grabbing like shovelware games and all that. But I thought particularly Blaster Master 01 was just a well put together game. It just hit a lot of those, well, what you want out of a Metroidvania, out of an adventure platforming game, whatever genre type you want to put on it, that you're exploring this interesting world. There's the upgrade system. You're getting new upgrades to go through different parts of the world, and there is some elements of backtracking. You go in and out of the vehicles, like you have that vehicle that's like iconic to Blaster Master. I just really enjoyed it as a game, and I think it's one that you don't really hear much about anymore, or the sequels. And I think it is one that, I'm sounding like a broken record, so I'll stop there, but I enjoyed it. It was one of my favorite Switch games from the early days of the Switch anyway.
I do, apart from the ones that we've already discussed, I really enjoyed Superland. I don't know if either of you have heard of it.
I've heard of it. I haven't played it. I know it's, they gave it away for free on the Epic Game Store at one point, yes. I think. Have it, but I haven't played it.
Well, that's how I played it, and it's a pretty, pretty sure that's how I played it. It's quite a good one, 3D type Metroidvania, and it's quite a large sort of world. There's a few different upgrades you can get, and I think they've done a really good job at design. It's a bit more fun-hearted than probably other Metroidvania type games, overall, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm just looking at screenshots. It looks very up my alley.
Yeah, I think from what I understand of it, I think you'd really enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check it out. Should have just got it on Epic when it was free. oh, well.
I think they are making a sequel for memory. But it's not
okay.
Well, having a look at, if you just click on Super Games, it seems like they've done a couple of, I don't know which came first, but maybe spin-offs. Like there's a Super Ball and a Super Land. Oh, here we go. Actually, this might be a sequel. Super Land 6 Inches Under. I don't know if that's a sequel or a
remake. I think that was sort of an expansion sequel, yeah.
Interesting. All right, well, yeah, it looks quite cool. And definitely,
it's on Switch as well, for memory.
I'm going to have to check that out. Well, I'm going to go for one that I think was kind of like pre the big renaissance of the genre. If renaissance is the right word. Again, it's probably more like the when it just boomed. Originally on Wii, but you can get it on PC, and I think maybe phone, though it's phone's a bit harder to keep track of with when things get delisted. But the Lost Wind games.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and they're pretty simple. They're pretty short. They're pretty cute. They were pretty, funnily enough, you look at Frontier, who developed them, and they're like, could not be further from a lot of their games they're probably more well known for today, like Elite Dangerous and Planet Coaster, albeit maybe a bit closer to some of their earlier things like the dog game on PS2.
It's very similar to F1 Manager, I'm sure.
Yeah, they clearly took a lot from Lost Winds and turned that into F1 Manager. Just a really simple one, sort of focus around elemental aspects, obviously wind being the first one, though the sequel delves into other stuff and seasonal things. I think they're good because they're short as well, because I think Metroidvanias can vary quite a bit. They could be like 8 hours, or they can be like the Prince of Persia. It's like a 20, 30 hour game, maybe 40 if you want to 100% it. The Lost Crown specifically I'm talking about. So I think if you're like, oh, I'm not sure, or oh, I've played these before, but I find them a bit too cumbersome, I think they're really, this is a good one just to take a crack and see if maybe some of the, again, those elements of the backtracking and, you know, taking this new ability back to here, if all that stuff maybe clicks for you with that sort of 3 hour span that these games probably roughly take to beat, I reckon it's worth checking them out. And again, probably one, because it was like a WiiWare game primarily, a lot of people would never have checked out, I don't think. And they're super cheap at the moment on Steam, like a couple of bucks or something. And I haven't done them on PC. I played them on Wii back in the day, but I can't imagine that using a mouse would be all that dissimilar to a Wii remote pointing on the screen. So I'm sure it'll play perfectly fine.
That was going to be my question, whether it was on modern sort of consoles/PC. So that's good. That's good. Yeah. It is accessible still.
Yeah, on Steam,
not trapped
at least.
Because it's not trapped on WiiWare/, well, the problem, I think, as we all know with iOS, is that a lot of those late 2000s, early 2010 iOS games are no longer playable anymore because they don't get upgraded for the new systems.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's why I even was hesitant to mention it being on mobile, because like it probably isn't because it hasn't been updated. But yeah, yeah. I think, again, if you're listening, I don't know when the sale ends, but yeah, on Steam, it's like $2 for both of them at the moment. So like definitely worth checking out.
I think before we close, the other one I'd bring up would be, if I can indulge.
Yeah, do it. Let's do it.
Another one that sort of maybe isn't even a Metroidvania again. So you can tell sort of what types of Metroidvania I like, but and is relevant due to a game that came out late last year, but The Messenger. I think I absolutely adore The Messenger as a game. I think, yeah, and I think that's an interesting example because The Messenger starts as like a traditional like Castlevania 1 and 3 like linear platformer, but you get to that point where, well, you the main trope of The Messenger is you switch between 8-bit and 16-bit graphics, and when it goes 16-bit graphics, it's more like a Metroidvania. There's more backtracking, there's more exploration, and yes, there's some downside to that in The Messenger in terms of there is some repetition in the enemies you face and the like when you're doing the exploration, and they start to reuse some of the boss fights and the like, but particularly some of those mini boss fights. But that's a game that, well, the world was great. Well, it was expanded into Sea of Stars, and I think it's just a, and I wouldn't really call it underrated, but I remember at the time when it first released that it had people that really enjoyed it and were talking about it, but at the same time, it did go under the radar of a lot of people, I think. So that's one that, that's one I've always been very highly, well, I guess glowing about when talking about it. I do like, I guess for me, it gets that sweet spot that it transitions from an action platformer to a Metroidvania, and that was a gameplay mechanic that they baked into that. So I think it's interesting from that perspective when we talk about, well, what is a Metroidvania and what isn't a Metroidvania.
No, I agree. Mario, any others you want to recommend while you've got an audience?
No, not particularly. Just, yeah, those ones. But definitely, if whoever hasn't played Hollow Knight or the Ori series, and I definitely recommend those. Even if you're not into Metroidvanias, you might find that you are into them once you play those.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good, actually, point to end on, in a sense, is like, it's definitely one of those genres you could have played, like, one and really bounced off it. But I think if you're willing to give it a crack, you can probably find the one for you. I think it's just about, again, knowing why you bounced off that one and then talk to people like us or friends, I'm sure. Like, these days, if you play games, you've got to know every one of your friends has a Metroidvania they like, I guarantee you, unless they just play Fortnite and they don't play any other games to date this podcast, because I'm sure it'll be some different game in the future. But yeah,
well, it's definitely not Power World anymore.
It's not Power World. But like, you know, if this was 10 years ago, I would have said Call of Duty or something. So, you know, just or,
yeah, you would have said Call of Duty and FIFA. Yeah,
correct.
Or Madden. Yeah. Or Madden if we're in America. But well, we're not in America, so yeah. we would never say Madden.
No, we'd say, yeah, definitely FIFA. Probably not Cricket Live 2007. Didn't really go off as big as Madden does in America. But yeah, like, you know, I think because it is such a, it's being explored to such great depths. Like, I clicked the, you know, preparation for this, and I was scrolling through it, the Metroidvania like tag on Steam, and it's just like an endless supply. And again, I'm sure there's some people taking advantage of the gray sort of areas that Brendan's touched on to just get themselves in that tag. Because again, it's probably good for search engine optimization, but you know, there's just so many. And so if you find one that's positively reviewed and has good vibes, you know, I'm sure you'll find one that clicks with you at some point. And then probably, yeah, just to, you know, look forward to the future, are there any upcoming ones that are on your radar other than Silksong?
If I could jump in first, I can't really think of any, actually. It's a genre that I enjoy playing, but I guess I am selective in what I play. So I generally will wait to see what people say about a particular game and then jump in. Like, for example, Prince of Persia wasn't really on my radar before it came out. I still haven't picked it up, but it is now on my radar, and it is a game I plan to play. So that's sort of how I take the genre personally.
Yeah, apart from Silk Song for me, I'd say maybe Animal Well looks like it could be an interesting one. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that one.
How much did Dunkey put that on your radar, or were you like interested in that pre-Dunkey?
No, well, I don't know when Dunkey mentioned it, but it was a friend who actually suggested looking into it. So,
interesting. Because, well, he's not just mentions it. Dunkey's now, like, publishing the game, his company that he made. It's the first game he's publishing.
Yeah, Big Mode, isn't it called?
Big Mode, yeah. Yep. Interesting. Yeah, I think probably the only one I'd add, and I did briefly mention it, but it's coming out pretty soon. I am curious to see how Tales of Kenzaru Zao goes, just because it's weird to root for a big company, but I do like it when EA do their like indie projects and they succeed, because it hopefully means they take more of their billions of dollars and fund it into these smaller projects.
Spoiler, Zach, they won't.
Right. Well, we'll see. I know they've got, you know, they did Joseph Farris' stuff for a while, and you know now they're doing this.
I just have to say that I just hate the title, and that you can't use Tales of. That should be trademarked.
Yeah, it is. I feel like you could almost just say Kenzaru. Like you probably should have just called it that because it's a made up. Well, I think it's made up as far as I'm aware. I think presumably
the location. Because I assume it's the world.
Yeah, the world and the game, and that would have been fine.
Because I think the character's Zao, which is why it's hyphen Zao. Well, yeah, ellipsis Zao. But I assume that opens up having more games, and I assume that's their idea that you'll have Tales of Kenzaru, another character name inserted here.
Yeah, very ambitious to go that route. Hasn't backfired for anyone before. Either way, it still looks cool. Certainly the concept of that sort of, you know, a bit more based in sort of loosely off of African-like mythology and beliefs, I think is neat. And the guy was super passionate when he spoke about it at the Game Awards, which, you know, I'm sure every game developer is passionate, so I don't want to say that's exclusive to him. But struck a chord, will be interesting to see how it shakes out, particularly compared to Prince of Persia, which I think has a very similar vibe, at least from just, you know, what I've played of that compared to this. But yeah, well, thank you both for coming on to chat about this sort of, you know, very current and probably will continue to be current genre for the next God knows how long.
I think it's safe to say it's here to stay at this point, Zach.
Yes, it's not going away anytime soon, and that's for a good thing. Mario, in particular, thanks for joining us as well and chatting. It was always good to chat with you and just have another voice on the podcast that isn't Brendan or I.
Likewise, thanks for inviting me on. It's always lovely to be here and share whatever input I can.
Yes, thanks for joining us, Mario.
If you want to speak to us, you can find us at BlowCartPod on the key social medias, you know, X or Twitter, Facebook, and we're on Blue Sky that we're not really doing much on there. TBD if we ever do. Depends if the website itself takes off, I guess. or email us at blowingcartridge@gmail.com or leave a review. If you leave a review, we will find it. We will read it and you can put your thoughts in there as well.
And definitely subscribe to us on whatever podcast service you may or may not use.
Yes, 100%. So you don't miss out on our hopefully continued streak that we're on at the moment for both, as we said, episodes every fortnight and guests. And if you want to reach out to me, it's at Eggerino on X and at Tamazoid for Brendan on X and I think Blue Sky as well. Mario, for if I recall, you're not someone that's actively in the social media space, if I recall.
Correct. I don't really use social media, but I have my Steam account and everything. Let's leave that out.
Okay. Does not want you to add him in and play what was that? What was the ball version of that game that you just told us before, which may not even be multiplayer. I'm just assuming it is. Anyway, thank you all.
Super Land Ball.
Super Ball, which I'm going to assume is multiplayer, but maybe it's not. Thank you all again for listening. And until next time, have a great fortnight.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.